I'd like to ask yourself to picture yourself as being an ancient Israelite. Put yourselves in their shoes for a moment. Imagine that you've been in slavery for a long, long time, and it seems that there's no way out. After all, it's been over 400 years, and nothing has changed. You know that God, through Moses, is saying over and over again, "Let my people go." And yet there's still stubborn pharaohs not doing it. There's terrible plagues that are affecting them, and still he's not letting God's people go. So at this particular moment, you might be feeling, well, it's just going to be another 430 years. And maybe there's that frame of mind that's very distraught. Positive attitudes possibly are waning. However, you have followed the instructions and you have put the lamb's blood on the doorposts and you stayed inside your homes. You kept the Passover. And while you could hear in the distant cries coming from other houses, you realize that your house has been protected. You still have life. And you're protected from the destroyer. The last plague reminds you and I of God's promise and his promises that are true, and that we are going to leave Egypt. What seemed impossible was now a reality for them. The Egyptians strongly desired for them to leave. God changed their attitude and heart on that last plague, and they wanted them to leave, get out of here and leave with haste. They had fear that more would come. Exodus 12 and verse 29, this is where we'll start today. Exodus 12 and verse 29. And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on the throne of the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house in which there was not one dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also." Be a blessing to get out of here. We're done now. So the people, well, let's stop there. I won't go any further. But basically, God broke the wicked stronghold of Pharaoh, which seemed impossible. And not only were they released from bondage, but Egypt wanted that separation. Leave and get away from us. At the end of 430 years, on the very same day, God's army of people, the children of Israel, went out of the land of Egypt. You know, what you may have had a hard time visualizing at this point, because it's gone on and on and on, the bondage. Now that all changed overnight. That changed, and it was going to happen. And they observed a night to be much observed. Drop down to verse 34. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up and their clothes on their shoulders. I mean, they basically said, you know, leave the land in haste. Verse 33, it says, the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste. They said, we shall all be dead. You know, get out of here in haste. So they took their dough before it was leavened, and they left in haste. Verse 35, now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. Well, you know, they worked for them for a long time. God said, you were underpaid. It's time to take the gold and the silver. It's due to you. Take it. And God and the Lord, verse 36, had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Drop down to verse 39, and they baked unleavened cakes in the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out of the land of Egypt. It is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. Now, other translations refer to the night, this night of solemn observance, as a night of watching or to keep vigil. Last night we spent time together, and it was a very important observance. And we, deeply respect that evening, and we reflect on the deliverance that God provided his people. We understand why we are to keep the night to be much observed. But why are we here today? On the first day of unleavened bread, why are we here today? And what does it picture for us today as Christians, the New Testament church? Why were the children of Israel commanded to keep the days of unleavened bread? Why not just the night to be much observed and move towards the promised land? Why do they also keep the feast of unleavened bread? And why do we do that today? Let's move forward to Exodus 13 and verse 3. It says, "And Moses said to the people, 'Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten.'" Well, that is also a reminder of how they left Egypt, which was in haste. They left, and it was a reminder of them and of the deliverance that God provided. Drop down to verse 6. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up out of Egypt. It shall be a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep the ordinance of its season from year to year.'" So they were to think about this as to be a part of them, in the forefront of their minds and their heart. They are to really treasure these days as well. They are to remember this. It's to be in their mouth. And of course, when we eat unleavened bread, too, we think about it going into us, and internalizing what these days mean and the fact that we can be righteous, that we can be delivered from sin, which is what Egypt is representative of. But the days of unleavened bread, it points back to the time that they had to leave so quickly. They had to leave in haste. But what a deliverance. How exciting would that have been? You think about, have there ever been times in your life, maybe it's a really bad boss that you have, you go in and it's you're a young adult, it's your first job, and the boss is just mean. It goes on and on and on, and you pray for relief. It doesn't happen, but then God delivers you. Maybe there he swaps a new boss. And that happened to me once. There was just a real challenging boss at Social Security Administration. Just went on and on and on. And basically said, this particular woman, she called me in. And it could have been a man as well. But he called me in. And she called me in, sorry. Does it matter nowadays, right? Yeah, no. No, just joking on that. But she called me in and said, you're really deserving of a promotion, but I'm not going to give it to you because I would lose you with the other job. I want to keep you with that. But you deserve it. We're going to give it to somebody else. Okay. So I know there was a stronghold there. She was not going to do this. And as long as she was there, she was going to keep me there. And it proved true. But when God wanted to deliver me from that, he did, and it happened quickly. And how he did it, in my mind, that it was him. But she got asked to be on a 2-week detail, to go to this. I don't want to go to Iowa. I'm going to have to be over there and help this field office. Okay. Well, he did that, took her out, was there for 2 weeks. Within the 2 weeks, the new person that was in promoted me. It was like she came back, and it was very interesting because She came back, and they called a meeting, and she had no part in it, and she's sitting there, and the other, just the three of us, they offered me the job in front of her. I looked at her, and she's like, I'll take it. But it is kind of funny how sometimes that works out. But, you know, that, you know, you all probably have stories where things go on and on and on, and then God delivers. And you're so thankful, and there's encouragement, and great encouragement, because you know there's been intervention by God. Israel, could you imagine how encouraging they would have felt? Leaving Egypt, he's doing it. He's going to get us out of here. They're leaving with zeal and enthusiasm, plundering the Egyptians. I'll take the gold, I'll take the silver, let's go, we're out. Could you imagine the great relief? It would have been at that core. Oh, do you remember when you were first baptized? The great love and zeal that you had for this new way of life and this commitment was so very encouraging. We know, and you realize, when God has set you apart at baptism, in that way, he sets you apart from the world. And for his purpose, you're now part of a holy nation set apart by God. And there is excitement that's at the core. You know you've been delivered from bondage, from a bondage of sin. And just as ancient Israel was to remember when they were delivered from bondage, we too remember how we have been delivered during these days. And we should. It should come to our mind. We should think about when we were baptized and that commitment and how God pulled us out. He drew us out of the world. Where do we usually go, though, to support God's command for us to remember these days? Of course, we go to the book of Leviticus. What is the book of Leviticus all about? What does it pertain to? The English name Leviticus comes from the Greek word ludikon, which it means that which pertains to the Levites. Well, there you go. This is just for the Levites. Some would say that. This was just for Aaron and the priesthood and just for the Levites. But that's according to that name, the English name Leviticus, that's according to Gleason Archer, a survey of Old Testament introduction, 1974. However, the book, it doesn't deal with the Levites as a whole, but mainly, and this is, you know, the book of Leviticus, it also pertains to the camp of Israel too. It does pertain primarily to the book of Levites, but also about how the camp was to be as well. But the book of Leviticus as a whole, it is mainly with the priests from the family of Aaron and the division of the Levites. But do we just ignore it because it was directed towards the Levites? Obviously not. And we know that all scripture is given to us for doctrine, reproof, correction, instruction, and righteousness, so that we become more perfect in good works. The book of Leviticus does help us see how God wants his people to be, and that we are set apart. The New Bible Commentary says the immediate purpose of this book, Leviticus, is set forth those laws and principles by which Israel is to live as the people of God. Their God is a holy God, and they are a holy people. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy, and it's emphatic demand. The book of Leviticus shows that God was present not only in the tabernacle, but the camp. He was concerned with how the people lived their lives. We strive to do this today in the church as we represent the church as God's holy people. We have been set apart. And so the standard that has been set is not a worldly standard. It's God's standard. At summer camp, we have what's called a code of conduct. And in that code of conduct, it's not based upon the world's code of conduct. And those that come to camp, they do agree to adhere to the code of conduct. And God gives us his code of conduct, his laws, so we are to follow. And that there would be a distinction in the way that we live our lives and the way that the world lives theirs. He has set us apart. And that key verse found in Leviticus is Leviticus 19, verse 2. We won't turn there, but it says, "Speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy." Today, as Christians, today, you know, even though Leviticus is an Old Testament book, today, the instructions still apply to us. The Apostle Peter recognized the importance of personal holiness when he admonished Christians to be obedient children. This is 1 Peter 1 in verse 14 through 16. 1 Peter 1 in verse 14 through 16. But he admonishes Christians to be obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts as in ignorance, but as he who called you is holy. You also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. Also in 1 Peter 2 and verse 9, Christians are referred to as a chosen generation, a royal priesthood. 1 Peter 2 and verse 9, called into his marvelous light. So even today, we are a part of a royal priesthood. And the instructions given in the book of Leviticus are not just for the priests from the family of Aaron, a division of the Levites. It's also about what was going on in the camp, so to speak. And it's for us today. Leviticus 23 in verse 1. Leviticus 23 in verse 1, where we see the feasts of the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord. Again, we recognize these are his feasts, and they're for us to keep, but they're his, and no other individuals can claim them. They're his feasts. But the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocation, these are my feasts. And he takes ownership of these feast days. They're his. The first feast, of course, is the weekly Sabbath. It is a feast day. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. Shall do no work on it. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. In verse 4, these are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in their appointed times. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. But you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days. The seventh day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. It's clear that God wants us to keep these holy days. And God has set us apart for his purpose. We're in his pasture, and we're to keep these holy days. They're very important to us even today. You know, why do Christians today, though, why do they need to keep the days of unleavened bread every year? And how does this apply to how we live our lives today and what's in our heart? Where are we admonished to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread even today in this day and age? And of course, you probably are thinking, of course, 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6. And we'll go ahead and turn there as well. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6. In the context here, the Apostle Paul is having to deal with sin. When we look at what the old leaven is that we'll refer to, it's talking about sin. Specifically, it was sexual immorality that they were dealing with as a congregation. And those that were kind of welcoming that and kind of putting a blind eye to it and, oh, well, you know, it's fine. Really, they were glorying in it, you know, and they thought they were being righteous by accepting it. Well, you know, I'm accepting this. I'm above. It doesn't bother me. You know, he's saying, well, it should. And here's the context of verse 6, chapter 5 and verse 6. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven, so it's talking about sin, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. They were to depart from sin, and they were to live their lives with all sincerity and truth And there's the meaning of these days that we keep, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We're to keep these days with all sincerity and truth. When Israel left Egypt with all joy and zeal, they started off on the right track. They were excited. But what happened afterwards? Well, the sincerity and truth was not there. They were very thankful to leave, but what was in their knapsack behind them? Well, they were dragging Egypt with them. The idolatry was still there. They built a golden calf, sexual immorality. You know, the things that they were very familiar with in Egypt, well, they were dragging it with them. They still had the old leaven in their knapsack. In the New Testament, Stephen, before his martyrdom in Acts 7, makes a very perceptive comment about the people of Israel at that time. Acts 7 and verse 35. Acts 7 and verse 35. It says, "This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, 'Who made you a ruler and a judge?' is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of an angel who appeared to him in a bush." Am I in the right? Yes, I am. "He brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear.' This is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke of him on Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us, whom our fathers would not obey but rejected, and in their hearts they turned back to Egypt." In their hearts they turned back to Egypt. What was in their core? They were excited at first. There was a lot of joy. But what was in their heart came out, and deep down within their heart, the first commandment did not mean much to them. They desired other gods. While they did leave Egypt in haste with the unleavened bread, what they desired was the old leavened bread. So how do we make sure that we don't make the same mistakes? How do we make sure that we truly stay unleavened, that we leave the old leaven behind and zealously depart from Egypt for good, that we keep that zeal, that we keep our first love, so to speak? We must keep the feast with sincerity and truth, with all thankfulness and joy. We do that for this week, but we must continue on all year and year after year and every day of our lives. What's going on in our heart matters. And are we thankful to depart from sin? We must love the fact that God delivered us. And we must love the truth. We must have a love for the truth. If we're going to live sincere lives, we have to love the truth, having no desire to be a slave to sin again, and being thankful for being freed from the bondage of sin. That has to be at our heart, that thankfulness and love for what God has provided us. And it has to stay with us. Romans 6 and verse 17. Romans 6 and verse 17, "But God be thanked," got an attitude of thankfulness right off the bat here, "but God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness." There's a thankfulness that we have in being set free from evil. This is a key for us to obey from the heart and to love God with all our heart, mind, and strength. God is very interested in what's in our core, what's being written in our heart and mind. And certainly as we digest unleavened bread during these days, we take that into our body, we think about what we should be taking in, which is truth, sincerity, God's way of life. The very mind of Christ is to dwell in us. And it's not burdensome. You know, think about it. We get to these days. Are we dreading them? Are we looking forward to them after the Feast of Tabernacles? And we're really looking forward to them right after the Feast of Tabernacles. I can't wait for that to come. The next Holy Days. And when we approach these days, are we dreading what we will have to eat during these days? All these tasty unleavened treats that we have for this special time. Put it butter and honey. Oh, terrible. Give me some more. Why do I gain weight during the days of unleavened bread? I'm not eating that much gluten. Actually, I'm eating probably more. Right. But, you know, we love it. It's enjoyable. It's not a burden at all. I don't know anybody that's hoping to trade these days for a Big Mac or pizza, you know. It's like we love these days. They're very special to us. And again, you know, when I was in college, many days, because I'm on the run, it was Taco Bell, and it felt like the days of Taco Bell, you know, and we changed that, and you know, we have different traditions, we enjoy that. These aren't the days of Taco Bell. We're thinking about taking in the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, and that God is transforming us. It's not about the physical as much as what the spiritual that's taking place. And we're reminded of the transformation that's taking place and what God has started in our lives. And we're appreciative of that. We're thankful. So I have a question for you today. That's the primary focus of the message. Do you love truth? Do you love truth? It is a major part of being sincere. It's a major part of keeping the feast of unleavened bread with the right perspective. Psalm 51 in verse 3. No doubt prior to these days, we examined ourselves pretty intensely, and we found areas that need to change. And so we hopefully approach these days with a desire to be different, a desire to be more like Christ. And we have that desire, but we should also understand what God desires of us. Now, this is a very familiar set of scripture with David, a psalm of repentance. And in his heart, he was convicted of sin, and he knew he wanted to be better. And that was a desire that he had. He also understood what God's desire was for him. Verse 3 of Psalm 51, "For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire," this is his desire that he's acknowledging, this is God's desire, "you desire truth in the inward part, and in the hidden part you will make me to know wisdom." In the inward part, in the core being of us, we want truth. We want sincerity. And when we eat unleavened bread during this time, we should think about our lives and how we live our lives. Are we living our lives with that love for the truth? Truth in the inward part. If we do, then we'll stop dragging Egypt with us. It's hard because technically we live in Egypt. It's very difficult. We have to wrestle against the ways of this world. You know, one of the main attributes of this world that we have been separated from, we are a holy people, it is untruthfulness. You know, that's a major part of this world, a lack of truth. There are so many individuals really have no problem lying, no problem fudging on the truth a little bit. It's just so normal. It's very prevalent. And really, there's a war on the truth. Satan the devil is warring against the truth and against the truth of God. He's the father of lies. He initiated the lies in this world. He's the father of this world. He's the father of lies. And so we do have to recognize that there in the world, there is a war against truth. And as God's people who are set apart, we must love truth and God's way of life. At the core of this world, there is not truth. And that's anywhere from artificial intelligence. You know, that's a major topic of conversation these days, and it can be in, you know, we think about that, but it's artificial intelligence. Intelligence that's not totally real. It gathers information from everywhere else and it spits back, you know, a lot of details that it gathers. It's kind of a two-edged sword, too, with what it can do today. But anywhere from also what the world's false philosophies that are out there and what is not true. A staggering statistic is that approximately 75% of all Americans believe in some sort of conspiracy theory. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. There's a book entitled Truth Decay. Not Tooth Decay, but Truth Decay. And of course, it's a play on words, but it's a nonfiction book by Jennifer Cavanaugh and Michael D. Rich. But it looks at historical trends of truth decay and how the decay is not a new phenomenon in American society. It's been there, and it's been eroding, it's been decaying. It's been decaying for 6,000 years, approximately, a very long time. What's one attribute of leaven? Well, it corrupts, it spreads. It's kind of like a decaying tooth. And the world has been decaying, or like a decaying tooth, for a long time. We live in a world where it doesn't really value truth, and lying is so normal. I believe it was careerbuilder.com, and it talks about you know, how many resumes that were so where people just have no issues lying. And many of the bosses are like, well, you know what? I hardly look at the resumes as much anymore because I don't believe what's on them, because so many just lie about what's on the resume. And they have no issue lying about, you know, about who they are, really, what they've done, what they've accomplished. As God's people, we must love the truth. We must value the truth and what is real. 1 John 2 in verse 15. 1 John 2 in verse 15. It says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, it is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. You know, we really can't love the world and love the truth of God or have truth in the inward part, because the world is so full of lies. And just a few lies that we're very familiar with, lies like, sin doesn't matter. There's no consequence for sin. Lies like the world isn't fading away and the lust of it. Go ahead and fulfill your heart's desire with whatever lust that you want. The lust of the flesh won't hurt you. There's no consequences. We have a pill for that, right? Lies like you don't need order or structure in society. We can all just do whatever we want. It will all work out. Lies like God doesn't care how you worship, just as long as you worship. You can worship him with a little paganism. It doesn't really matter. Just worship him however you want, just as long as you worship. Another lie. You know, it's all lies. It's what the world is promoting, and there's many, many other lies out there. But if we are to live our lives with sincerity and truth, these are things that we must be aware of. We can't have a love for the world and a love for God at the same time. We can't have our cake and eat it too. Especially during this week. We're told in Romans 12 and verse 9, let love, and of course we're talking about loving the truth, having truth in the inward part. Romans 12 and verse 9, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil and cling to what is good. To love the truth and to love God with all sincerity and truth, there are some things we can't love. There's some things that we can't follow, but it's the love that the world has. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1, it talks about the love of the world in these end times. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1. this is how the world is described in the times that we're in today. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. So again, stressful times will come. Why will it continue to be stressful? Think about the last 20 years. Does it feel more stressful now than it did 20 years ago or 30 years ago? It just kind of feels like things are being ratcheted up a little bit more, a little bit more. But why is that? A big part of it is the attributes in the world today and how things are changing. Perilous times will come because men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money. Now, these two right here, lovers of themselves, lovers of money, now it has a whole lot of other attributes to follow. And these attributes are very much tied to lovers of self, lovers of money, as you listen to these descriptions afterwards. Boasters, well, lovers of self. Proud, lovers of self. Blasphemers, disobedient to parents. Unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving. Slanders, without self-control. Brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty. And then, what's more? More lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And so we're told what the world loves, stay away from it. If we are to love the truth, if we really love God's way of life, we can't love this. Having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. There are some we can't be around because we love God and the truth more. Notice James 3 and verse 17. God's way of life, those that love God, those who love the truth, there's a far different fruit, there's a far different attribute, there's a far different love that God has called us to be a part of, where it's that sincere love, the without hypocrisy. And there's a major contrast between the world and what he has called us as his holy people to be a part of. James 3 and verse 13. James 3 in verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, if that's in the inward part, do not boast and lie against the truth. So we can't have the truth, we can't love the truth, if any of those attitudes or attributes are there. I mean, if you look at the details that we just read in Timothy, you know, the brutal despisers of what's good, slanders, you know, this hate that's there. That's not a love for the truth. That's not wisdom working. It's not a godly wisdom working. This wisdom does not descend from above, but it's earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy. This would be the fruit that is tied to those who love truth. If the opposite here is one that lies against the truth, and now we have the attributes, what does that say about one who is adhering to this type of godly wisdom? Well, it's the fruits of righteousness and truth, as we'll read on. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Sincerity is what's there. These are the essence of the attributes of building up one another and a love for what is true. The final trait listed, it complements the other differences between genuineness and play acting. It is without hypocrisy. That means without a mask. There is truth on the inside and the outside. It means that what a man appears to be, he is. And we would say maybe the common expression, what you see is what you get. What you see is what you get. And there's no two-faced anything going on. and had an individual share a story with me. There was just so many politics at work, and you know, there was one employee, and they would constantly just talk about other people as soon as they would leave. And he'd be so nice to them, and then after they'd leave, he would share with this other gentleman some pretty bad thoughts about the other individual. Finally, one day, he said he went to the break room. He pulled out two Dr. Peppers, and he went back, and he set it on the guy's desk. He goes, "Oh, you got me two Dr. Peppers?" He goes, "Yeah, one for each face that you have." And he was tired of the two-faced. Wouldn't it be nice to do that every time? But, you know, it's insincere. It's a mask. You know, when you live two separate lives, it would be very challenging. It would be stressful to not live a sincere life. Because when one starts lying, you better have a good memory to keep up with the lies that you've told. Michael de Montaigne, he said, as a quote, "It is not without reason that people say that whoever doesn't have a very good memory should not be involved in lying." Mark Twain is quoted as saying, "If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything." When we live lives that are true and without hypocrisy, it's a blessing. It's a blessing to us as well. If we're the genuine article. Masking can be a very challenging and stressful thing. I mean, I would think being a con artist, wouldn't that be one of the most terrible things to do? It'd be very stressful. Wouldn't that be very stressful? Always lie. Always have to try to cover your steps. A long time ago, me and a prior pastor in Kentucky, we were conned out of some money by an individual that claimed to be wanted to be a new member in the church, and he had this job that was about to start, and he just needed a little bit. He got paid on that, like 2 days later. I give it right back. I just have to do it for, and did that to me and another individual. And then when we talked separately, we both realized, well, he got both of us, and he was already out of town. He went by the alias named Joe Klumpert. That wasn't his name. There's nobody with it. And so, you know, you learn from certain things. But I think, boy, what a stressful thing that would be to have to live that way, to have to try to con people, skip town, cover your tracks, move on to the next. Like, where is he now, I wonder? Where is Joe Klumpert, alias Joe Klumpert? Ananias and Sapphira came to mind, too. God knows what's in the inward part of man. He knows what's in the heart. He knows what's sincere and what's not. Living a life of sin, a life of lies, it's never going to pay off. It's only going to create stress on others around us, but on the individual as well. But to be unmasked, to be the genuine article, wouldn't that be wonderful if everyone was unmasked? Because everyone lived sincere and truthful lives. You know, what will it be like in the millennium when all will know the truth? We'll be able to be unmasked and live by the truth. The teachers won't be backed into a corner. It's so wonderful to be the genuine article. And at the same time, we must also be aware of those who continue to mask, those who do not have the truth in their inward parts. The Pharisees were liars. They wanted to kill Jesus Christ. They hated Jesus Christ. They wanted to kill him. They hated his authority. They believed that they were righteous too. And Christ said that they were of their father, the devil, that they were hypocrites, like whitewashed tombs that look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside full of bones and dead and everything unclean. At the same time, that wasn't enough just to explain what they were, but he warned the true disciples of the leaven of the Pharisees. He warned them. And we should take that to heart as well. He said, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Beware. Luke 12 and verse 1. Luke 12 and verse 1. In the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together, so that they trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples, "First of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. For there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever you have spoken in the dark will be heard in the light, and whatever you have spoken in the ear in inner rooms will be proclaimed on the housetops." Why did he feel it necessary to warn those? I mean, he could have just educated them, but no, he gave a warning. Beware. Is it possible that he thought that they could be susceptible to their lies, that they might easily fall for it while seeking what was best? The more one is around an insincere individual, the more susceptible they are to follow the same lie and become a hypocrite themselves. Why are we told in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, do not be deceived? Do not be deceived. There's some lying involved here. Do not be deceived. Something is not right. It's not true. Do not be deceived. Evil communication corrupt good manners. Or another translation says, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. So it's one thing to recognize what hypocrisy is. We can look at the traits in Timothy again, go down the list of attributes, slander, discord, whatever it may be, lovers of self, boasters, proud. You know, but it's another thing to say, hey, be careful. Be careful who you surround yourself with. Don't be fooled. You know, there's a real danger to follow the teachings of leaven, whether it be false philosophies, false teachers, and philosophies of this world. One major philosophy that is being taught in this world is postmodernism. And it means, you know, basically there's no universal truth. And they reject that there is absolute truth. You know, they believe that you have your truth, I have my truth. You have your opinion, I have my opinion. There's no truth. Well, that's enough to make somebody kind of go insane. If there's no truth, then what matters? And if no one can reconcile what truth is, it leaves you in a quandary. But this does apply to immoral behavior too, this postmodernism thought. There is no truth. That's their formula. We use a different formula. Let's take a minute and look at this equation as we wind things down. 1 John 3 and verse 18, and we'll go ahead and ask them to pull up a slide here. This is God's formula for sincerity and not having hypocrisy. Let's turn to 1 John 3 and verse 18, and I'll leave the slide up a little bit off to the off to my right. 1 John 3 and verse 18. First John 3 and verse 18 says, "My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth." Let us love truth. Not just in word. We say we love truth. I love truth. I love truth. I love truth. Well, not just in word, but in deed in truth. And by this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him, because we live it, because the truth is a part of us, because it's what we do. It's how we live our lives. For if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence towards God. Whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. So as we have up on the slide here, the formula is words equals deeds and equals no hypocrisy. When our words equal our deeds, there's no hypocrisy. But if words are greater than our deeds, well, there's possible hypocrisy there. And if our appearance equals our life inwardly, there's no hypocrisy. But if our appearance does not equal our life inwardly, then there is hypocrisy. And that's what we're told in 1 John 3 and verse 18. can leave that up for a minute and then pull it off the webcast or whenever you feel like it. But this is God's formula for sincerity and truth. This is the formula that we must live our lives by. Truth in the inward part of our lives, in our heart and in our mind, so we live it, that our deeds match what we believe in. This is something we study, it's something we strive to remember, and God wants us to remember this during these days. It's very important that we think about that and think about our actions. And this was something that he did not want ancient Israel to forget. And year after year, they were to keep these days to remember what he pulled them from, what he delivered them from, not so they could go back to it. They ended up complaining and wanting to go back to it. But year after year, we're to remember, hey, we needed the deliverance. And we want to stay on that path leading to life. And if we do, it's imperative that we love the truth. We don't know how much time we have in any way. We don't know how much time we have until the return of Jesus Christ either. And just as Christ warned his disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, we too are given warning of a man of sin. And truth is so very vital. 2 Thessalonians 2. And verse 7, 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 7, says, "For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth." Does the love of the truth matter? It matters. Not only that we say we love the truth, but that we live according to the truth. "They did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who do not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." Again, it backs up the actions, what we do. It's the unrighteousness. That's the one who does not believe in the truth. It's what they do. Those who do not love the truth do not live by the truth. It's not the way they walk. What is in their heart is not obedience to God's law. What is in man's heart comes out. And what must be in our heart is truth. So let's make a commitment this week and for the rest of our lives, each day, to always tell the truth and live the truth. 3 John 1, to conclude. 3 John 1, verse 1. 3 John and verse 1. "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health, just as your soul prospers. For I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you." The truth that is in you. The truth that is in the inward part. "Just as you walk in the truth." The truth that is in us, it comes out in how we walk, whether it's really in the truth. "I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth." John greatly rejoiced of the truth that was in them because they walked in the truth. If we are to keep the feast with all sincerity and truth, then we must live that way, not just for a week, for the rest of our lives. If we are to have truth in the inward part, we must walk in the truth. The mind of Christ is in us, and we love the truth. We love the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.